Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Well, everyone, welcome back to a very exciting episode of the Storybox podcast. Today, my friends, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Mark Hauser to the Storybox. Now, for those of you that don't know who Dr. Mark Hauser is, you're in for a real treat because he does a lot of work in the realm of trauma and helping people that have been through adverse childhood experiences and all those things that we actually do end up going through as kids and that end up affecting us later on in life. So I believe you guys are going to learn a lot. Now, instead of me gushing all about your wonderful work, Dr. Hauser, I thought I would ask, instead of me doing it, would you be willing to share a little bit about who you are, what you do, and why you do it?
Sure. Yeah, sure. So first, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here today. I actually spent a year living in Brisbane. So little connection there. My graduate student roommate is an Aussie who actually is at UQ. So I have a nice connection to living in that part of the world. My background is that I was trained really in biology as a scientist, as a basic research scientist with a specialization in kind of the neurosciences and evolutionary sciences. So that's kind of sort of three pieces of who I am. So part one is as a scientist. Part two is as an educator, which really started a long time ago, 25, 30 years ago, with teaching undergraduates in college, graduate students, postdocs, other professors, depending on the topics. And then for the last 14 or so years, taking my knowledge in this area to work with children in schools, mostly in kind of the special education arena, who have different kinds of disabilities, which includes children with various kinds of traumatic histories. And that work is also not just done in the United States, but internationally. I work in East Africa. We are working with children who have been orphaned. Kenya, as some of your listeners may know, is a country that has almost 3 million orphans. Sub-Saharan Africa, 54 million orphans. So the populations are massive. And of course, the issues that I'm sure we'll get into are equally massive. That's the sort of the second component as an educator. And then the third is as an author who has written, other books before. And I see that as an important link between the two first pieces, which is that to me, there's an extraordinary amount of important knowledge tucked away in scientific literature that often doesn't make its way into the hands of people who really need the information. And in this particular case, for my new book, Vulnerable Minds, I see my audience as teachers, doctors, nurses, social workers, policymakers, as well as the parents potentially and individuals who have been hurt by various kinds of adverse childhood experiences.
Welcome so much to the Storybox podcast. I'm sure we've got a lot to uncover with just that response alone, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask, how did you find Australia? How did you find Aussies? You can be brutally honest.
I love Australia. And my youngest daughter, who was with us, if she could move tomorrow, she'd move to Australia. I think it's a beautiful country. I love the openness of the Australian people. Obviously, generalizations are always generalizations, but there's a joy of life, I think, in Australia that I think is very resonant with me. It's in some ways somewhat of the similar, I think, openness of spirit that Americans often have, but it's a little wilder or more adventuresome. Exploration is a big part of who Australians are, I think. You know, I just love the beauty of the nature. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful country.
Having seen the Australian culture versus the American culture and all these different other cultures as well that you were describing initially, how have you found, or why is it the case that some cultures are more open and more receptive, say, than other cultures in terms of their vulnerability?
I think that's an interesting question. I mean, the United States is really founded on an immigrant population. It is an entirely immigrant population. And I think just because of the nature of the geography of Australia, it's just very different. And so I think the U.S., you know, maybe things are changing. I think the U.S. is becoming, like many countries, unfortunately, maybe much more guarded about bringing people into the country, which I think is very unfortunate, because I think the strength of the United States has always been the large diversity of people. And from diversity comes a lot of really interesting things. But I think, you know, that is, for me, I mean, my father, who's still alive and 92, almost 92 years old, was born in Berlin and then moved to France and then was a child during Nazi-occupied France during the Holocaust. His mother, you know, was, you know, so a German-Polish background to his parents. My mom's parents were Russian. So I have a very strong, you know, diversity in my own background. My wife's family is Danish. And so there's just an extraordinary diversity. And then our youngest daughter was adopted from Russia. So, you know, we ourselves have a pretty big mix in our own. And I've lived in Kenya and Uganda. And so there's a real, you know, diversity in our cultural backgrounds.
I get the whole cultural differences. I mean, my great-grandparents, both, they fought in World War II. They were both fighter pilots, believe it or not. One was on the English. Oh. The other one was German. So I've always wondered whether or not they met each other in the skies and shot each other. That's sort of like a running joke in the family.
Yeah.
But I've always wondered about, you know, why is it that some people, is it more or less about the culture? Is it more about the person, the individual, how they've grown up, what they've seen, that dictates whether or not they are more vulnerable with another person, or they're more closed off or guarded, or like more their family upbringing, that sort of thing, do you think?
Yeah. So I think, like in everything human, it's a mixture of nature and nurture. And how those two interact. And, you know, in the book, I describe in quite detail my father's own story. And I think it'll be an important theme today. But when we think about the nature of resilience, and how some people fall more onto the resilient side of the world and some people fall more onto the vulnerable. And I think it's really nice visually for people to get in their heads, your listeners today, this spectrum from vulnerable to resilience. And you're not stuck on one part of the spectrum, that's something that can move depending on various experiences. But biology plays an important role here. And when I think of my father's own experience, just to give kind of one example, he was a young child who, based on his parent vision, felt that they would be safer if they kind of split up as a family. So they would find some home or a Jesuit group that would take my father for 2 to 3 months. They leave him off, come back 2 or 3 months later, pick him up, move him again. And that was his life for 4 years of the war. Mm-hmm. Now that's for a child who needs stability and safety and protection and familiarity. All that was thrown out, okay? But his parents, in some ways, created a world for my father that, for anybody who's seen the wonderful movie Life is Beautiful, was kind of like that. They created a sense of safety. He'll be okay. And that they were there for them. And they were absolutely loving, devoted parents. Of course, the challenge was he made it through, but everyone else in the family was killed. So only his parents survived. There's no surviving members from the Holocaust at all. And so here is someone who's now going through the rest of his life as an only child. They only had one child, only him. His parents were the only survivors along with him. But he's the most resilient person I know. Part of that is who he is, incredible strength of character to fight for himself like that, and a supportive family environment. He also happened to be a brilliant man who went to Harvard and got a PhD in physics and was a very distinguished scientist, then turned himself to climbing and all these other things. He's just got incredible power as an individual. So it's a combination. And I think, one of the things that I'm sure we'll come back to a little bit more too is that when we think about resilience, certainly experts in the field want to really think about kind of multiple systems that are involved in resilience. There's certainly the individual. And so the analogy I draw in the book is, think about a gymnast, right? So they may be, a floor expert, but some of them are going to be competing in multiple sports. And it's not just them, it's their team, it's their coaches, it's the National Gymnastics Associations, it's their physical trainers, right? Everybody's contributing to when you get a great gymnast like Simone Biles. It's not just her, it's the entire team around her, which in her case included her parents and everybody else. And so I think that's the way to think about, resilience. I would never be Simone Biles. I don't have the skills of a gymnast. I'm a good soccer player. I'm not a good gymnast, right? She had that talent. So you couldn't turn me into Simone Biles because our biologies are just different. So that's where we'll go today, is that we want to be thinking about these individual differences. And that's why in the book I make a big deal that we need to be distinguishing between adverse childhood experiences, which are the experiential part, and one's response to those experiences.
Yeah. Is resilience inherent within all of us, or is it taught?
The capacity to bounce back, I mean, is part, I think, of human nature. We are a resilient species. And I think, George Bonanno, who's wrote a book on kind of the nature of trauma and resilience, has nicely pointed out, and the science certainly shows this, that in many cases of pretty extreme experiences, the more common response is a resilient one. The traumatic response is less than that. And that, I mean, that includes, veterans of war who have experienced quite significant, traumatic experiences, and yet many, the majority bounce back. I want to be really careful here because I think a lot of people who have written about that, the conclusion, which I think would be disastrous, is we don't have to worry about kids because they're just going to bounce back. And yet, when we think about, some of the recent statistics coming out of the World Health Organization, that approximately 1 billion children every year are maltreated across the globe. And of those, 40,000 die each year. We're talking about a significant part of the world population that is potentially harmed. And we know that the young brain is fragile. The earlier in development that adversity occurs, the more likely it is to harm that child. And so we can't be lulled into the position that resilience is the norm, because it may end up saying us, well, I don't have to do anything.
I agree with you on that point. I don't think it's wise at all just to go, oh, the child is going to bounce back, because it's inherent within human nature for that child. It's like a click, it's going to switch all of a sudden. They're going to be able to
That's right.
bounce back fairly quickly. But it's like, if they don't have the information at their fingertips, if they don't know what they don't know, how they're going to actually bounce back. So they don't have someone that comes alongside them to help them and say, hey, it's going to be all right, and here's why it's going to be all right. Because I've been through the same thing. If a child doesn't see someone else go through the same thing that they've gone through and be all right, it's like a learned behavior at the same time. So sure, I agree with what you were alluding to, that the ability to bounce back, but there's also a learned component as well that comes along with it. I mean, I was reading Ross Edgley, The Art of Resilience. I don't know if you've heard of that book. And you've got this culture in Japan where They're really, really tough. They do like these crazy endurance feats. I think it's called Ikigai. I think that's the terminology. And they push themselves to the absolute limit, doing incredibly hard things to build that resilience. And I guess you could say he boils it down to like this muscle that we've got. Is that something you would align with or agree with?
Yeah, I think there's a nice, I mean, there's a kind of a nice metaphor analogy to it. I think where I go differently is trying to go beyond the kind of metaphorical muscle idea, to really think of what's now being discovered, in terms of the biology underlying the capacity for resilience. And so I think one of the things, and I'm sure we'll talk about this a little bit more, is that I resist in many ways, and the book is an example of this, the broad scope use of the term trauma, as well as the broad scope use of resilience. They become part of the colloquial kind of lore, and I think to great harm in some sense. There's a general sense which comes out in some ways of the clinical literature, at least things like the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, that people often refer to trauma, in terms of response to violence, that either seeing violence, as the case of war veterans, or being physically abused or sexually abused. And those are certainly ways in which one can have a traumatic experience. But we know well that children who have been neglected, where there's no violence, have distinctive traumatic responses. And kind of a phrase that I bring up in the book, which I think is an important one, is that depending on the nature of adversity, one ends up with different traumatic signatures. And it's important to understand those signatures because they guide what we can do to help. And that's important. Whereas we say, oh, well, this is a child with trauma. I, as a person who works with kids, I don't know what to do with that. That doesn't help me. That's saying, like saying, you're sick. Okay, now what? Right? That's not helpful. Whereas the science is really maturing in a way now that we can speak about these signatures. And let me just give an analogy. This has happened recently with family members where they were told, you had a stroke in this area called the occipital lobe, which is the area which is involved in vision. And saying that you had a stroke in the occipital lobe is like saying that you have a bleed somewhere in your body. I don't know what to do with that information. So we now know a lot in terms of the brain that when certain areas are damaged, you get these signatures of the deficit. So there are certain areas that are involved in language production and other areas that are involved in language comprehension. And depending on where they're damaged, you may show a production problem or a comprehension problem. In the same way, there's a tiny little area between kind of your temporal lobe that when that area is damaged, a common deficit is you don't recognize faces. That's very specific. You can recognize bodies, you can recognize the voice, but not the face. Okay, that's important. Those are signatures of brain deficits. The same is true with traumatic experiences. They lead to signatures that are key to medical, psychiatric, developmental, educational treatment. And it's important that people understand that so they can help.
Before we dive further into trauma, because I do feel like today's society has sort of made trauma like this buzzword now, and people are just using it for all kinds of different reasons. Like they get whatever it is, they get a terrible text message, oh, it's traumatic or whatever it is. But I want to go into today's society and today's culture. I've been noticing a shift, and it's almost as if like we are trying to coddle young kids. And I don't know if you've seen the same thing. I get that there's a lot of kids that have been through some terrible experiences, and we need to help those kids for sure. But then there's the other side. A vast majority of the culture is saying, no, we need to wrap these kids up in cotton wool, and we don't need to let them develop any kind of resilience at all. And there's kind of like this victim mentality and mindset coming through. I don't know if you've noticed the same thing, but I see that as being dangerous. I think we need to teach kids that the victim mindset is not a good mindset to go down. Have you noticed the same thing at all?
Yes, I think that's absolutely the case. In fact, there's a new book out. I'm blanking right now on the title, but which speaks precisely to this issue, that this kind of constant helicoptering or nurturing parenting style has made kids more vulnerable rather than more resilient. That, you know, what, I mean, I'm a little bit older than you, I think, you know, when I was a kid, I mean, my parents, you know, I went out riding my bicycle in the community, went down to the pond and, you know, played with frogs and all these other things. As long as I was coming home in a reasonable hour, I don't think they care where I was, you know? So I think that, you know, the book that came out a few years ago, The Coddling of America, you know, yeah. It's not just America. I think it's much more of a global thing. But I, you know, again, I think maybe in certain societies that's happening. Certainly when I, you know, do work in Kenya, that's not the kind of model I'm seeing in Kenyan society. So I think it's certainly a part of certain Western societies, relatively wealthy nations. It's certainly happening and it's backfiring. There's certainly a recognized crisis in terms of youth's mental health. But it's fueled by many, many things. And I think many of your listeners will be kind of aware of this. Some people point to social media and smartphones, which certainly is part of the ingredient. Some people point to this kind of overbearing, nurturing, protective parenting, which is another piece of it. You know, social media is has been a help in that mental health has become less of a stigma than it is in many parts of the world, in Australia and the United States and Britain. You know, saying that you're someone who suffers from clinical depression is no longer, oh my God, it's like you have a disease, right? That has changed. But the flip side of that is you have things like on TikTok, where hashtag bipolar is one of the most common hashtags. I mean, that's frightening. And so we are in schools now with kids coming, I have bipolar. Who told you? Oh, TikTok. No, you know, these are clinical diagnoses, self-diagnosis. And it's absolutely devastating because, of course, as happens in so many things, you start telling yourself those stories, some of those issues are going to begin to unfold. And so I'm anxious. I've got anxiety disorder. I've got attention disorder. Now, all of a sudden, you're inventing those things. So we're living in a very difficult time, in part because of the self-diagnosis problem, in part because of all the things that have happened with helicopter parenting, in part because of what's happening with social media. But I do sense there's beginning to be shifts. In many of the programs I work in, there's a ban on using cell phones. Kids turn them in the beginning of the day, they pick them at the end of the day. Done. No more, you know, that problem's gone. Of course, they go home and they're on it right away, but they're certainly learning to cope without that tool. And so I think that shift is beginning to happen. And I think a lot of parents are beginning to realize that let kids play, right? But that's going to take time. We've had decades where that's not happened.
I'm still quite young. I'm 27, but even like when I was growing up, I wasn't helicopter parented. I was allowed to fall over, hurt myself, and even do some difficult and hard things. And I went through a lot growing up with my health and with just life in general. And that sort of informed a lot of my viewpoints of the world and how I was raised too. It was a good thing. My grandfather taught me a lot. I had to deal with the loss of my grandfather, who taught me a lot. And just dealing and navigating with these difficult circumstances was challenging. But the older I get and the more I deal with things, if I didn't have that basis or that foundation as a kid, and if I didn't have people that would come alongside me as well, that would say, hey, it's going to be okay, even though I didn't feel like at the time it was going to be okay. Right. But as time went on and the older I got, the more mature I got, hopefully I got more mature. I'm just kidding. But yeah, the age that I'm at now, I'm just like, it's okay. And I feel like these young kids, they're being ruined by these false messages that you can't, it's not going to be okay. Like if you take the easy way out, because it's easy, that's going to be more beneficial for you, which is the wrong kind of message.
Yes.
Now you've got these weak-minded men that treat women terribly, that I think the statistics on masculinity is going down incredibly. It's really low. You're seeing the rate of dating and relationships, they're failing as well. And it's all stemming from these terrible TikTok trends and ideas that young people see on social media, that it's like, this is going to be okay, but it's really not. And I think another one as well on TikTok that's really popular is not just bipolar, but it's also multiple personality disorder as well.
For sure.
That's trending.
Yes. Absolutely.
And that's concerning to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's right. And I think, I mean, the other part too, is that I think there is an over emphasis on therapy as a solution. So, you know, grandparent died. You need to go see a therapist because you're sad about it. Well, that's just part of life. You're going to lose grandparents, right? And, you know, that plus many other kinds of things that people are going to experience. My book is really focused on these heavy hitting types of adversity. It's not losing a grandparent. It's not moving homes for a third time. It's losing home completely, losing parents completely. These are the kinds of deep-seated adversity that are often chronic, that kids are living with. Poverty, the war in Ukraine and Gaza, where kids are seeing horrific things that no child ought to be exposed to at that early age, or any age for that matter. But so I think that that's part of it as well, is that we've gotten so diffuse in our terminology that any kind of difficult situation is treated as a trauma. Mm-hmm. And that undermines in some ways, especially the scientific work that is explaining how chronic adversity kind of, you know, so to speak, gets under the child's skin and affects their immune system, their autonomic system, and their nervous system, and why that's important to understand so that we can do the right thing when there are those responses and help them recover from that and hopefully build resilience going forward. So, I mean, you know, the story I like to tell, which I sort of remark in the book, is I have an old friend, and I remember one day I was downtown in a town I was living in, and he looked incredibly upset. I said, you know, hey, what's going on? He goes, it's like the worst day of my life. I said, well, what happened? He goes, my son's soccer match was canceled. I'm like, are you kidding me? If that's the worst day of your life, man, I want your life. you know, so that gets bled, you know, into I'm living in poverty. I mean, I am seeing children who at the age of 4 or 5 are being beaten or sexually abused by parents and relatives, and they're living in that world. That's not missing a soccer match, right? So that's the important piece that we need to understand. And even with those kinds of kids, some of them bounce back from that. They have a kind of a core resilience, or they find in schools loving teachers who care about them, and that enables that safety to be rebuilt and the sense of trust of others. But if we bleed these terms, then we are failing to help the people who need the help.
Speaking of these really terrible experiences, like a child experiencing war, and all these explosions around them, like in Ukraine and Gaza, for example. When a child initially experiences that, there's a feeling of shock that comes over the system. And then is there a point, if they've seen it on a repeat basis, day after day after day, and they're still alive, is there a point where they sort of get numb to it all and it becomes their new normal?
Yeah, so... one of the things that was a kind of almost a little surprise to me in my own system was when the war started up in Gaza following the attack by Hamas on October 7th, I was going to actually write something about kind of the impact of war on children, because there's an entire chapter in the book on war and children that includes both children as child soldiers in war, which is one piece, which would include children in gangs, and children just expo not just, but children exposed to war. And you get so embedded in your writing that you sometimes forget some of the little subtleties of what you were describing. And so when I went back to the chapter, I'd forgotten in some sense that the opening paragraph is about an event in Gaza in 2021 about a family that was bombed. And I thought, oh my God, here we go again, right? And so both interestingly, ironically, and depressingly, some of the best work on the impact of war on the developing child, as well as parents, comes from a very distinguished neurobiologist, Dr. Ruth Feldman, who's an Israeli neurobiologist who works on Israeli children in Gaza. So it's right there. Okay. So she has found a lot of very, very important things. But one of the things that I think is really critical, and it relates to your question directly, is that one of the systems that gets knocked out, both in the mother and the child, is empathy. And think about empathy. So just to kind of put it in a simple sense, there are kind of scientists tend to think about two kind of senses of empathy. One is kind of an emotional, unconscious sense of empathy. That's kind of like a resonance, right? So I see you, Jay, sad, and I kind of automatically feel sad if I'm an empathetic person. Or many people will understand this one. If I yawn, and you see me yawn and you're an empathetic person, you're beginning to feel tired and you start yawning. And if I more I talk about it, the more tired you're going to feel, and so forth. And interestingly, in both psychopathy and autism, contagious yawning doesn't really happen because empathy is a system which is a deficit in those two types of disabilities. So in war, that system, oh, see, I can tell you're going to yawn.
Yeah, you caught me.
Hey, that's
Talking
okay.
about
Well,
yawning
as
makes me want to yawn.
as I told my two young daughters, when they go out on their first date, yawn. If the guy doesn't yawn back, just walk away. We're done, right?
That's clever.
So the interesting thing, and of course, the incredibly sad thing, is that a mother whose empathy has been in some ways knocked out by war is not going to recognize the cues in her child who is sad, upset, because she's not resonating with that child's emotional expression. And as a result of that, in part, as many developmental psychologists have described, attachment is fundamentally like a tennis match. It's a serve and return relationship. Baby serves up a need, parent returns the serve. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean that everything a child serves up should be returned. If a three-year-old says, "I desperately need a smartphone," sorry, dude, serve is out of bounds. No, you're not going to get that. Okay. But when the timing of serve and return is relatively synchronous, now you have the beauty of attachment. What war will do is disrupt that synchrony because the empathy system has been knocked out or at least greatly suppressed. And so what Ruth Feldman's work really shows is some of the impact of that. And as a result of that, there are these consequences downstream. That child loses those pro-social skills of being kind and engaged with other people. The social relationships begin to diminish, right? Because of that, they lose trust. So in the schools I work with children who have been exposed to domestic violence or physical abuse, their trust of others is very, very low, if not extinguished. One of the things I do often in schools when I'm teaching with kids, because there's a diversity of kids, they'll say, look, let's imagine a scale of trust. Zero is no trust, 100 is 100% full trust. A new kid comes into your classroom. Where are they on the trust scale? 9 out of 10 times, zero. They can't trust anybody. They lost that. The world seems so unsafe that trust is a fragile, fragile concept. And what schools can do, and that's where the magic happens in good schools, is they begin to show that irrespective of what that child does, that teacher, that nurse, that counselor is there every day to be supportive of that child. And when they see that, that trust begins to go back up. That scale begins to go from 0 to 10 to 50 to 70, and it begins to build back up. But that's what war can do. It's constantly that child is on high alert. There's a system in the brain called the amygdala, which is very fundamentally related to our emotional processing. It valences the world, positive and negative, often really linked to fear. For them, that system is on high alert because the world feels unsafe. And part of what recovery can look like is getting to understand that not all worlds are unsafe. Now, of course, a child living in Gaza today, how are you going to teach them that? That world is constantly unsafe. So for them, that sense of unsafety is what they're living daily. But when war subsides and hopefully stops, that's where the hard work begins because you have to say, hey, we're now in a more calm period. We're not going to be bombed all day long, right? But that's hard because the child's lost trust of the world. The world is unsafe.
They've lost trust of the world, their nervous system shot, they've got no empathy anymore, their connections are fragile at best. I mean, how do
Correct.
you rebuild a child from that?
So I think a lot of it depends on the context in which you're working with that child. And I think this is where, maybe unlike many books that are about trauma that really focuses on the Western world, to me, the important piece of my book is to really take a broad cross-cultural lens. And there are two reasons for that. One is the nature of the adverse experience, in some sense, needs to be defined in part through the culture. And here's what I mean by that. In a lot of the work that tries to explore the nature of children's adverse childhood experiences, there's one entry into those kinds of questionnaires, which is, were you physically abused? So let's think about that concept. Were you physically abused? Were you hit, struck, hurt so bad that it, hit so bad that it hurt, kicked, by a parent or family member? Okay. So in some states in the United States and in many countries, it is perfectly legal for a teacher to hit a child who's being misbehaved. Corporal punishment is legal in the United States, 19 states. So if you ask the child, were you hit? They're not going to necessarily process hitting as necessarily unusual or beyond the norm because, yeah, they've mouthed off and a teacher slapped them. That's just what happens in my state. That's just what happens in my country. So just the configuration of what counts as physical abuse may get coded very differently. That's one thing. But that's equally relevant to how you think about recovery. So one of the things that I do in the book is, for example, talk about how do you help a child who is a child soldier recover? And one of the critical pieces is how the community sees that child who is now an adult. When that community sees that child as a victim rather than a predator, that's a very, very different stance for recovery for that child. Because the community is now saying, look, it was not your fault that you killed these people. You were a child who was effectively abducted, or you had no choice. And so part of the healing is having a community be receptive to that and having that child understand in the same way that a person who was sexually abused, who may be seen by a community as damaged goods, right? It's saying, no, you were the victim. Okay. So part of the healing comes from a shift in the culture's attitude towards that individual. Okay, so that's one thought about healing, and those are aspects that are very need to be very culturally sensitive, right? So I can't take my American psychiatric lens and say I'm going to plunk down in the middle of Kenya or Bali or China and just use my approaches because it's totally culturally insensitive. Okay, so that's part one. The second part, and this is really the last part of the book, part three, is on the healing part. It's the hopeful part. How do we help people recover from the diversity of experiences that it may have led to a traumatic response, heal and recover? And here is the notion of a kind of a trauma toolkit, right? That there is never going to be one tool that will fit all traumatic responses. And that comes right back to the notion we started with, which is these traumatic signatures. Yeah. That people are going to respond in different way, even to the same kind of adversity, right? There are individual differences, and those individual differences need to be taken seriously. For some, talk therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy will work wonders for certain individuals, and that's sufficient. For others, therapy along with certain kinds of medication may be sufficient to calm the system and allow for growth and recovery. For others, they are treatment resistant to medication and therapy, and they need something else. And so what I try to do in the book is offer up this menu of options, both so people understand there are different things that can be done. And part of the differences come from thinking about different environments in which things can be done. It's not simply in the therapist's office. It's not simply with your doctor or psychiatrist. It's happening in schools. It's happening in communities. It's happening with parents. And so it's key that people understand, you know, we need a community of people and professionals who understand these things to ultimately help people recover.
Can you, at some point after being through all of that, can you be fully recovered?
Yes. I think there's a real hope there that we have many, 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 many cases of clear, hopeful recovery. And I think this is important. And I'll just give an example because I think it's important to talk about some of these cases where it looks hopeless. And here I talk about in the books, which some of your listeners may be aware of, the kind of the revolution going on now with psychedelics as a treatment form along with therapy. The key piece for your listeners who may have heard about this is that this is not just, you know, taking MDMA and having a fun time, is psychedelics that's therapy assisted, and that therapy is key. And that's why there's some concerns about kind of legalizing this as an approach, because the therapy is key. It's not just any old therapy. It's therapy of a certain kind with real trained experts who are linked to understanding the role of the psychedelics. But let me give you two examples. And these are recent studies that have been published, and they're focused on adults, but they're focused on adults who have a long history of suffering from major depression on the one hand or PTSD on the other. Psilocybin or magic mushrooms used for depression, MDMA or PTSD. These are beautiful studies. In some ways, the details don't matter for right now, at least. But here's the key piece. All the subjects in both studies for depression and PTSD were long-time sufferers where medication and therapy did not work. They were, in other words, treatment resistant. 12, 13, 14 years suffering for long periods of time. They now go on to these psychedelic-assisted therapeutic approaches. And what they find in both studies is approximately a 60% elimination of the clinical criteria for depression or PTSD. That's extraordinary, right? Now, small sample sizes at this point in time. We don't have thousands of people who have been treated, right? Not the kind of, let's say, diversity of people who have been treated, but it's an incredible sign of hope. They're also not longitudinal. These people have been followed for 10 years to see if they pop back, right? Just like Ozempic as a weight gain issue, which has become kind of crazy. We don't have long-term studies of that either, okay? But they are signs of hope of other kinds of treatment in the trauma toolkit that hold out hope that people can truly recover. I know just from personal experience with the hundreds of kids that I've worked with, of kids who've absolutely recovered. They've gone on to have extraordinary lives. Children that I've seen in the orphanages in Kenya, where due to the nurturing of the people working in the orphanages and in schools, these kids have gone on to go on to college where they had nothing. They arrived in the orphanage almost no clothes, having been completely deprived of shelter and food and cognitive stimulation. And now they're in college and now they've got jobs and families. So absolute recovery. So absolutely recovery is possible from difficult situations. Again, my father, as an example, from war, 4 years of war, where it probably seemed to him as a child completely hopeless, right? But here he is today, 91 years old. Okay. So that's the hopeful piece. But I think to me, a really important message is that we don't have this umbrella term sense of trauma, that we don't use it colloquially, that we try to use it in a more clinical sense, and that we think about the magnitude of children in the world today that are being subjected to different kinds of maltreatment that is leading to a traumatic injury to their bodies and brains, and that the science is really matured in a way that can help kids recover.
Do you agree with trigger warnings at all?
I think they're important, but I think, like the helicopter parenting, they've been taken to excess. And I certainly, I'll give an example. I just gave a talk recently to a large group of educators, including teachers, and counselors and school psychologists. And as I walked into this room, they were all laughing because they were people they had known each other and they're having a, a grand time. And I was like, man, am I going to be the party pooper today? And I said, you all know why you're here today. So let's see if we can come down a little bit for now. And so it was a little bit of a trigger warning, but they knew why they were there. They came for the workshop, they knew, but that was it. And then I proceeded to tell them, which I often do when I give a talk, is tell them about four real cases of people who have been exposed or were exposed to very difficult types of situation. And that was it. I didn't say, if you need to leave, please leave. That was it. I'm going to talk about these issues, right? Because you need to know these are real people who have had a real experience. And many of you know these kind of people. Okay. And you deal with it every day, as do I. Okay. So I think we've gone too far in this. It's almost parallel to the use of the word trauma, right? You get a trigger warning if you're going to talk about racial discrimination. Okay, it's a hard topic. I'm not saying it's an easy topic, but why do I have to warn you about it? Okay. I don't want to be insensitive here. We are talking about people who've had excruciatingly difficult lives. Every day I see children whose lives I want to cry. I come home, I've got to chill out because it's difficult to see them. I'm often involved with children who, because of their experiences, can be very violent to others and to themselves. And I often may be involved in a situation where I have to physically restrain them for their own good and for the good of others. That is not easy. That's the real deal. Okay. And seeing children who have been abandoned, that's the real deal. It's not easy. But if we protect people too much, they won't come to grips with what's going on. I'll say something further. Many of the people I work with who work in these schools, they themselves had childhood experiences like that. Every time they're with those kids can be triggering for them. No doubt about it. right? Because just seeing, feeling, smelling, hearing, all the senses get flooded. Yes, that's why we need to give people strategies to deal with that. But buffering them isn't going to help.
Did you see, I think it was in the UK recently, the BBCP or whatever they're called, the rating system, they recently bumped up the rating of Mary Poppins from G or U to PG because of discriminatory or racist language in the film. And one of the examples they used was the chimney sweep scene, saying that it was promoting shameful flirting and blackface. And yes. I could not believe what I was reading. I'm like, this is a pure example of going way too far. Shameless flirting on a rooftop, and the guy has a job at the chimney sweep. He's going to obviously get soot on his face. It's going to look black. Like, what are you going to do about it?
Right.
Was
no, like, no, that fits along in the United States with Dr. Seuss being banned.
Yes.
Because the Sneetches had stars like the Jews. And so it was basically a Nazi propaganda machine. I mean, no, it's gotten out of control. And, you know, again, it's interesting that you bring this up because in the many of the schools I work in, I do a class with these kind of kids on critical thinking where we discuss some of these hot button topics. And I brought up Dr. Seuss and I said, look, let's get started with the first conversation. Can we all agree that there should be age restrictions for certain things, right? Like, I don't want the three-year-old reading The Hunger Games or Lord of the Flies. Like, I'm sorry. They don't have the mental wherewithal to deal with that. Good. But at some point you do, okay? But banning the book for anybody is insanity. And so, again, that's kind of the helicopter parenting issue, but in schools where we're banning them from dealing with this rather than coaching them, guiding them through the material. Because you know what? Outside of school, they're seeing much worse.
Oh, yeah.
And so I run into this all the time. There's a class I've been teaching recently on the power of music, because music is such an attractive space to help kids deal with emotions and language and imagery and all these other things. And I wanted to show this school the movie Whiplash.
Oh, I love that
now,
movie.
Maybe some people I love that movie too. Yeah. But it was banned by the school because it's abusive. And I said, you know what? Yes, it's abusive, the guy, how he related to it, but they are seeing so much more horrible thing with nobody to guide them. I want to sit down with them and say, how did that make you feel? Why did it make you feel that way? Could he have done something differently there, right? What was wrong about it? Okay. Because they're seeing coaches yell and hammer athletes. They're seeing these things. So again, that's permeated the school systems. And it's gotten to the point where teachers are intimidated. You're seeing this, of course, in the US on university campuses. Our ability to speak about things that are controversial is getting closed down. And so we're in a very, very difficult space where we ought to be helping children navigate this space rather than buffering them from it.
You're a very rare individual, I find nowadays. Unfortunately, that is the case because you have a lot of professors and what have you in college campuses that are teaching this whole idea of victimhood, and it's okay to, I think there was a video that I saw that they were talking about a particular subject. I can't remember what subject it was, but they said, if you get offended at any point in this lesson, you can leave. And I'm like,
yes.
Oh, okay. So that's an easy way out. That's a cop out. And my advanced English teacher were watching Schindler's List, and that movie, I mean, it broke me apart, honestly. And there was a couple of nude scenes in there, and a couple of my classmates were going, oh, nudity, nudity. And she goes, get over it. It's they're humans. Like, grow up.
Right.
And I'm like, Right. Yes, yes, miss. I love it. Because it wasn't anything sexual at all. I think there was a sex scene with Schindler. But she even said, you've got to watch it. Put yourself through it.
Yeah.
It's part of life. Right. She's like, you're going to be at that point at some stage of your life. She wasn't trying to coddle us at all. And I highly respected her. I can only imagine what she thinks of a lot of the kids nowadays, to be honest. But it's just really absurd how you've got all these kids that don't really know how to critically think. They don't know how to think for themselves. It's about it's not about how to think anymore. It's about what to think. And I think that is really sad. And it's the plight on the next generation of young kids.
Yes. No, I think that's right. And I think kids are now so overly sensitive. I'll give you just an example. This happened, a year or so, a couple of years ago. The raid on the Capitol had just happened. And I was teaching a class kind of on civics and human rights. And I said, look, I want us to listen to then President Trump's speech. And I just Googled, President Trump's speech, and that thing. And I pulled it up. And this kid stormed out yelling, well, you're biased. You, of course, picked the CNN clip. I said, well, all I was showing was his speech. It was by CNN, but I wasn't giving you an interpretation by CNN. I said, it was just this president's speech. I said, you went off the deep end. I said, come on. I said, it was just the speech. I wanted you to listen to the words and come up with your interpretation. But he was gone. And I was like, oh my God. And he probably went home and told his parents that I'm like a lefty liberal, who just hates Fox News and da 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 da. But that's the pressure that teachers are also under, because they're so worried about being canceled or fired or disciplined or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm certainly careful, but I'm always worried that I'm on the fence, because I want them to come to grips with controversial topics, especially the kids I work with, where their traumatic experiences have often delayed some of their cognitive and emotional functioning. One of the things I talk about in the book, and this is something that's being globally felt, and I'm sure all of your listeners, especially those maybe working in schools or parents, one of the things that's important to understand about the response to adversity is the age of the child. And when we speak about this child has had an adverse experience and is therefore traumatized, the age is critical. So let me give you an example that was felt globally. When COVID hit, it deprived teenagers of a fundamental need for social interactions. Yep. Teenagers need social interactions the way that babies need milk. It's a critical or sensitive period of development. And if they don't get it, they have been deprived. What we are now seeing as a consequence of this is socially immature kids, because they were deprived. What happens, therefore, in the classroom is that we are dealing with kids who may be 16 years old, but they're kind of like 12-year-olds. And so that has to create a totally different lens on what you can do. So coming back to the earlier example, Hunger Games for a 16-year-old, totally cool, but not maybe for a 12-year-old. And so that's what we've got. So you've got to be shifting your age sensitivity, but it also means you need to be giving them experience. This is how you interact with somebody when you're 16 years old, not 12 years old, right? And so those are huge shifts, and that's why that lens of age is such a key dimension of thinking about the nature of adversity and its impact on potentially traumatic responses.
Yeah, COVID's really sent us back quite some ways, especially young kids. The rate of mental health, the crisis that was created with that, because they handled COVID lockdowns and everything like that so poorly. And I was watching Dr. Phil recently on The View, and it was amazing to me because Dr. Phil was basically talking about facts on there, and the View host had the gall to argue with Dr. Phil, who was a very well-respected psychologist. And I'm going, what is wrong with you people that you're arguing with a well-respected psychologist that has got years of experience and he's done the research, he knows the literature, and he's seen kids that are damaged from the COVID-19 pandemic. And then they let him talk for like, I think it was a minute and 30 seconds, and they quickly cut to commercial break. And I'm like, well, that is sad. Let the man that knows what he's talking about, let him speak. It's okay.
Yes.
He's talking about the reality of a lot of young kids' experiences, and we are seeing the result of what took place. You can't hide that anymore.
Yes. Right. That's right. No, that's right. But I think your point is, which is very good, I think brings up a parallel point, which is, and this goes back to TikTok.
Mm.
There are so many self-proclaimed gurus, experts, and so I think people have lost the ability to distinguish between people. So, for example, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not going to pretend to play one on TV either. So I have certain experiences as a scientist and as a teacher, and I'm going to say that's where my experience comes from, right? I'm not going to say I'm a therapist who uses psychedelics. I don't. I know the science, I know what's been published, and I can tell you about it, okay? But unfortunately, all over YouTube, all over TikTok are these self-proclaimed gurus who seem to know everything about everything. And so I think the general public has lost the ability to distinguish, right? So when CNN or Fox or whoever gets an expert on, I want that to be genuine. There's someone who has worked in, let's say, military intelligence. They were the head of CIA. They are a distinguished lawyer who knows about legal issues, about human rights. I want somebody who really is trained in the area they're speaking about. You know, that doesn't mean I couldn't give an opinion about something else, but I'm clear that it's an opinion that's not based on a lot of facts or experience. Mm. And that, I think, has been lost. And so, you know, again, I know you've had a lot of people on your show who come at the issue of trauma as experts, but even that notion, right, has to be qualified. Experts in what? If you're a psychiatrist, that is your expertise. Have you worked directly with kids in schools? Probably not, right? And so it's important that we get a lens on this so that when we're taking in the information, it's qualified by the expertise.
I had Dr. Bessel van der Kolk on of The Body Keeps the Score. So I got a chance to unpack a little bit about his experience dealing with a lot of people that have suffered through a wide array of traumas.
Absolutely.
From young kids to adults, and his entire journey from where he came from to what he does now, it's truly incredible. And so that means I would respect a lot of his work as a professional and having a lot of experience compared to somebody that is a self-proclaimed expert on the subject of trauma, has got nothing to do at all. All they're talking about is their own personal experience and what they learned from their own personal experience. And that is it. Like, I would much rather listen to Dr. Bessel or yourself or Dr. Paul Conti, highly respectable individuals that have seen a vast array of different people, and they don't only just talk about their own experience, they're talking about others' experiences too, and they've got a huge array of knowledge to back it up as well. So I think that is so much more beneficial for people to actually listen to and go, all right, it's still okay to question what this expert is saying. Like, I still question what Dr. Phil says, I still question what Paul Conti says, I still question all these things, because that's okay. That is part of critical thinking. That is part of growing. So it's not shutting that down and saying, oh, just because this person says it, that means it's gospel. It's so.
Right. No, that's very well said, because I think, you know, the beauty of science is that trained experts can disagree, right? Yeah. The lens that, you know, Bessel van der Kolk takes on the issue of trauma is going to be different from the one that Paul Conti takes on trauma, that's going to be different than the one I take, in part because of the nature of our actual experience in those areas. And even two different psychiatrists will have different lenses on what the appropriate psychiatric approach is. Some are much more focused on the medical side, the medication side, some more on the talk therapy side, some on completely different techniques. What I greatly respect about Bessel van der Kolk is he too has the view of this kind of trauma toolkit. And he's been a leader in many ways of exploring different ways of getting at this. And so I think, you know, that's very, very commendable. Does that mean that I agree with everything he says? No, but that's part of how we grow, all of us.
You're allowed to disagree. And my yes. problem is, in today's day and age, you have a lot of people that go, no, what I say is gospel. You're not allowed to disagree with me. Science is not the ability to question. I am the science. You need to be quiet. You need to go away and only listen to what I'm saying. That's it. And I'm like, yes. No, that is a dangerous line of thought. We live in right. a free society. We should be able to question scientists. Dr. Gabor Mate, for example, he worked with Dr. Bessel van der Kolk as yes. well. And even right. had disagreements. He's admitted that.
Correct.
But they still yes. have a high level of respect with each other. It's like
totally
that level of respect in the disagreement has gone out the window. And it's now I'm going to attack you for your belief or your word against mine. I'm right. You're wrong. Leave me the hell alone, so to speak. You can't have a
That's problem right.
anymore. And I think that just for young kids seeing that, it creates a world of problems. And not yes. only that, it annoys the hell out of me.
Yes. No, and I think, I mean, it blurs the distinction between science and religion, right? Religion is an ideology where this is the way the world works. And this is not a criticism against religion. It's just saying there's a difference, right? Science is about, in many ways, disagreement for growth and the pursuit of some aspect of truth. And so, whereas that's not the pursuit of religion, right? Although, I mean, there's one version of it, but science is a version which is there are many ways to think about the world. We're trying to get our best approximation of what is really going on. And I think especially, you know, in the space that we've been talking about, the science has really grown dramatically to help shape how the brain and the body are responding to these adverse experiences. And I think that's what's so exciting is that, and that's really where the hope comes from, is that the discoveries are really driving the hopeful interventions.
I know you've had a busy day, doctor, and I know we've gone a little bit long, but I just want to say thank you so much for your wisdom, your advice, and for joining me today on the Storybox podcast. Where can people find you? Where can they connect with you and learn more about your work?
Sure. Yeah. And it's been a pleasure and a really delightful conversation. So I appreciate the opportunity as well. I think the best place is my author website, which is simply Mark D. Hauser, Mark with a C from a French father, and Hauser, Hauser. So markdhauser.com. And that's where, you know, links to my books, to my papers. I've got a lot of links to my published scientific papers. But also books and other podcasts and appearances. So that's probably the best place to go.
I'll make sure it's all linked in the show description below. But Dr. Mark Hauser, thank you so much for joining me today on the Storybox podcast.
Thank you very much, Jay. Great pleasure.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.